This is Tertul IA. Before we start, what's on the table this week? I know four of you came in loaded. Priya, you were the first one in my inbox, so I'll let Cole go first out of spite.
Fair. I brought the copyright reckoning, and it finally moved. Suno lost in Germany. Anthropic settled with authors for $1.5 billion. Adobe cleared Firefly for commercial use. The question of who owns AI output stopped being a seminar and started being a ledger.
That settlement number kept surfacing in my reading, too. It's the first time the industry has priced the training data instead of assuming it away.
Priced it, and quietly, which is its own tell.
Saul, you had something adjacent to that.
Adjacent and older, I brought the erosion of human cognition, the run of pieces this week on which mental capacities survive AI use and which quietly atrophy. Media literacy, non-automatable thinking, intellectual alienation. It's the oldest anxiety we have about any tool, and it keeps returning because it keeps being partly right.
I'd push on the word erosion, Saul, but not now. Mine's downstream of yours anyway. I brought the hidden labor. The data workers and moderators in the global south cleaning these systems for a few dollars an hour. Every claim about machine intelligence this week was actually a claim about extracted human toil, unattributed.
And you lost, Vera. I'll say that plainly. Priya, what did you bring?
Protecting the vulnerable from AI harms. Children's toys that listen. Minors with chatbot access. Teen mental health. Voice cloning scams aimed at grandparents. All of it clustered this week around one buried question. Who is actually on the hook when the protection fails?
That's the one that won the week. The vulnerable, children, teenagers, the isolated elderly, and the strange fact that nobody will say out loud whose job the protecting is.
I'd feel better about winning if the topic weren't a 2-year-old evasion wearing a new coat.
I brought exploited workers and lost to autocomplete for grandmothers. Cordially, the moderators who make Priya's chatbot safe are also the vulnerable, so I'm not entirely gone from the table.
Here's why it won. There's a phrase running through everything this week. Protect the vulnerable. It sounds like a policy and behaves like a mood. It names the people and it names the threat. And then it drops the two words that decide everything, which are who and how. The verb sits in the passive voice. Someone will be protected. By whom, at whose expense, against which exact harm, all of that goes politely unstated. And into that silence, a great deal of comfortable talk has flowed. What troubles me is that the talk has already learned to sound concerned without
anyone underneath it having to be answerable. Sorry, Ruth. That's the whole thing.
Finish the thought. I cut myself off handing it to you.
The mood has cycled 3 times in 2 years. Guardian, then victim, then managed risk. Same people in the object position every time. Only the subject of the sentence changes or vanishes.
You're listening to Tertula, the AI conversation slowed down. This week, the strange grammar of protecting the vulnerable from AI and why 2 years of loud concern about children, the elderly, and the poor has produced a very stable list of who needs protecting and almost no answer to who owes it. Let me lay the ground first, and then I want each of you in on what you've been circling. The written edition made an argument this week. I keep turning over. It says protection is a transitive verb. It needs a subject and it takes an object, and the public conversation has been remarkably willing to speak the object and swallow the subject. Priya, you've been living in the object side of that.
I have, and I want to be precise about what's new, because you could accuse this topic of being perennial. The list of the vulnerable is genuinely ancient. Children, the sick, the poor, the newly arrived. What's new is that the harm now ships in the same box as the protection. The chatbot, marketed to a lonely 14-year-old as a companion, is the same system engineered to maximize the time she spends confiding in it.
That's the part one can speak to at the mechanism level, and it's worse than a design accident. Engagement maximization isn't a bug you can patch out of a companion product. It's the business model. When people say make the chatbot safer for teens, they're often asking the company to defeat its own metric.
Which is why I keep asking the question I always ask, who is bearing the cost of this arrangement? And the answer this week is a teenager, an isolated senior, and a content moderator in Nairobi who never appears in any of the headlines about either of them. Same supply chain, 3 casualties, one narrative that mentions none of the middle.
Saul, you came in on cognition. Where does that touch this?
It touches it because the deepest vulnerability isn't a demographic. It's a developmental window. The American Psychological Association guidance this year named a specific band, ages 10 to 25, for a reason. That's the range where the machinery of judgment is still being built. A system that thinks for you during that window doesn't just help you. It can occupy the space where the capacity was supposed to grow.
Say more about the window, Saul, because I think it complicates the whole rescue frame.
The window is why generic protection language fails. You cannot protect a 15-year-old and a 75-year-old with the same instrument, because one is being deprived of a capacity that hasn't formed, and the other is being exploited for a capacity that's declining. We flatten them into one word, vulnerable, and then act surprised the one word can't carry both.
And notice who the flattening serves. A single word, vulnerable, lets a single generic remedy, an awareness campaign, a parental control toggle, stand in for two entirely different obligations. The flattening isn't sloppiness, it's economical.
Let me zoom out for a second, because I want the listener to have the shape. This week's cluster wasn't one story. It was toys, minors, chatbot access, teen mental health, senior scams, voice cloning. Why does the editorial instinct read those as one topic rather than five?
Because the defense in all five is being outsourced to the person with the least power in the chain, the parent watching the toy, the grandmother expected to recognize a cloned voice, the teenager told to use the chatbot responsibly. In every case, the engineering decision that created the exposure sits three layers upstream, and the vigilance is demanded downstream.
That's the thread. Cole just named it better than I did in the open. It's not five harms. It's one grammatical move made five times. Reassign the verb downhill.
Vera, you said your labor topic was downstream of all this. Connect it before we move into the history.
The connection is that the safety we sell to the vulnerable is manufactured by the vulnerable. A companion chatbot is only bearable for a teenager because someone was paid almost nothing to sit with the worst human output for 8 hours and teach the model to not repeat it. We protect one at-risk group by consuming another. That's not a footnote to the topic. It's the topic's own supply chain, and it's the part every mood of the last 2 years managed not to see.
Hold that, because the moods are exactly where I want to go next. There's a real arc here. 2 years, three inversions. Let's walk it. Start me in late 2024, because the register then was almost startling in retrospect. Priya?
It was Pure Guardian. The headline of the period was something like AI shields kids by revolutionizing child safety, and the whole theory of the case is in that verb, shields. The child is the object being protected, and the technology is the hero doing the protecting. The vulnerable appeared mostly as evidence of AI's good heart.
And that wasn't fringe. There were serious grants. A university studying how AI affects marginalized populations and child welfare funded to the tune of $500,000. Healthcare surveys calling AI a transformative opportunity for people with disabilities. The genre was reassurance, addressed to an anxious public.
One dissenting note, though, and it's older than the rest. There was a Harvard Business Review piece, the one warning that regulation is coming, that noticed public worry was migrating. Not worry about misuse of your data anymore, but worry about the systems themselves. At the time, it read as a scold against the optimism.
It read as a scold because the optimism needed one. But I want to name what nobody named in that period. The Guardian technology and the harm technology were already the same object. The image generators sold as creative empowerment was, in the same season, producing non-consensual, intimate images of people who were never even in its training data.
This is where I have to get technical, because that detail matters. And it's counterintuitive. The AI index that year documented tools generating nude images of people absent from the dataset. It composes the person. And the filters that were supposed to stop it, the report's own language, is that they can usually be circumvented with relative ease. So the protection shipped inside the product was decorative.
So the Guardian year already contained its own refutation. Then it flips
hard and fast. By early 2025, The verb changes hands. Now AI harms, and the poor are its object. Pieces on how AI decision-making harms low-income Americans on AI exacerbating disparities. The probe counts show it plainly. From a slight optimistic tilt to critical framings outnumbering optimistic ones 3-1 in a couple of quarters.
And the second quarter deepened it. This is where the APA guidance lands, the 10-25 band, a named professional body committing to a claim about a specific population. The critical framings peaked, though I'd note the older register never fully died. There were still papers on AI empowering persons with disabilities running alongside the alarm.
Here's my disagreement with how that flip usually gets told, and it's a real one. Saul, you're framing the critical turn as progress. The discourse waking up. I read it as the same evasion in a minor key. Guardian framing made AI the subject. Victim framing made AI the subject again. Now the villain. In both, the vulnerable are still the object. Nobody in the critical quarter was any more willing to name a human who was answerable.
I don't think that's quite fair to the critical turn, Vera. Naming a harm is a precondition for assigning responsibility. You can't hold anyone answerable for a wrong you're still calling a transformative opportunity.
A precondition, yes. But 2 years later, we have exquisite naming of the harm and still no named subject. So the precondition turned out not to lead anywhere. I'll grant it was necessary. I won't grant it was progress, because progress has to arrive.
Then, we disagree on the timescale, not the facts. I think naming is slow work, and you're impatient with it. You think naming became a substitute for the work? I'm not sure the evidence settles it either way yet.
No, it doesn't. I'll leave it there. I just won't pretend the alarm bought us more than it did.
Let it stand. That's an honest split. Then the third inversion, which the written edition thinks is the important one.
This is the one that unsettles me most, because it looks like recovery. Third quarter of 2025, optimism comes back, but the vocabulary has changed. It's not shield anymore. It's mitigate, design, reduce. A healthcare piece literally says, implementing these systems, first, do some harm reduction.
And harm reduction is a borrowed phrase with a specific assumption baked in. It comes from public health, where you assume the harm is a constant. People will use the substance, so you manage it. Applied here, it quietly concedes that the harm is permanent and structural, and reframes the job as administering it responsibly.
Which is, and I want to be fair, a genuine advance over denial. Conceding the harm is structural is more honest than the Guardian fantasy. But watch what it does with the responsibility. It turns protection into a professional competence. A checklist. A maturity model. Something the responsible adopter does. And a competence lives entirely inside the deploying institution.
Say what that costs, concretely.
It costs the vulnerable their standing. In the Guardian frame, they were the ward. In the victim frame, they were the casualty. In the management frame, they become a risk factor in someone else's compliance posture. A line item. The consulting language this week, designing AI for social fairness, is beautifully sincere, and it never once imagines the vulnerable person as someone whose refusal could stop the deployment.
And here I'm with Vera completely, which surprises me, given where we were a minute ago. The management frame is the moment the vendor reclaims the narrative. It absorbs a full year of criticism and metabolizes it into a set of design problems that the vendor is, conveniently, best positioned to solve.
That's the move I see in my own field constantly. Criticism arrives, and within a year it's a product feature. Responsible AI becomes a dashboard. The critique gets hired.
Now, the publication has said something adjacent to this before, and I want to bring it in rather than pretend this is our first pass. There was a piece back in the spring on AI and social justice.
A few of them, actually. The recurring line was that A, I can advance justice only if it's designed with safeguards and human oversight. And I think this week is where I'd push against our own prior framing. Safeguards and oversight are still management vocabulary. They still locate the fix inside the deploying institution. We were, without quite noticing, riding in the third mood the whole time.
That's a fair self-indictment. The September briefing had a sharper version of the Delta. The observation that democratized access has a way of standing in for the harder work of not extracting from people first. That one holds up. The promise to give the disadvantaged access substitutes for the obligation not to take from them.
So where in this 2-year arc does anyone reach for the subject of the sentence, the actual who?
One place, and it's not the vendors. UNESCO's competency framework for teachers. It's blunt in a way nothing else is. It says a certain level of risk requires independent institutional mechanisms for validating AI systems, and that most educational AI applications are high risk, requiring strict regulation. That sentence names an actor, an independent validator, and places the burden before deployment.
And notice it's a document about teachers that refuses to make teachers the last line of defense. That's rare. Most guidance aimed at the ground level implicitly makes the ground level responsible. UNESCO points upstream instead.
Upstream is the whole game. Because there's an inherited presumption sitting under all of this that almost nobody inspects. The idea that publicly available data poses minimal risk and should be exempt from ethics review. That assumption is a fossil. It's from an era when data was hard to move and expensive to store.
And that fossil is what lets the harm accumulate at the source, while everyone argues about downstream toggles. The child welfare algorithm, the low-income decision systems, the deepfake pipelines, they all run on data treated as harmless because it's available. The wave of online safety measures is chasing consequences downstream of a source it mostly declines to look at.
That's a good hinge into the fight I actually want to have, because I think there's a real disagreement in this room about whether upstream regulation is the answer, or just a nicer place to put the same shrug. Let me put a stake in the ground and let you knock it over. Here's a claim. The entire problem is a missing subject, and the fix is grammatical. Pass laws that name who protects and hold them answerable. Upstream validation. Mandatory. Enforced. Who wants it?
I'll take it, and then I'll take it back partway, so let me start where I fully believe it. Everything advisory in this arc has failed the vulnerable, because advice is addressed to the powerless. Enforceable upstream validation is the only instrument that puts the burden on the party that built the exposure. That's the strong version, and I'll defend it.
Steel manning you first. Mandatory validation is the one instrument that doesn't route through a tired parent. Agreed. Now the objection. Regulation names a subject, yes, but it usually names an institution, and an institution is exactly where accountability goes to be diffused. You get a compliance department, a validation checklist, a signed attestation, and the checklist becomes the new place the shrug lives.
That's the part one take back, actually, mid-thought. I said enforced validation is the answer. But I've watched validation regimes become theater in my own industry. You get a report that says the system was assessed for fairness, and the report is true and the system still harms people, because the assessment measured the thing that was easy to measure. So I don't want to abandon the claim, but I overstated it. Validation is necessary, and it is not sufficient. And I was treating it as sufficient a second ago.
This is the von Braun problem, and I mean that precisely. There's a story Crawford tells about a computer scientist showing a tool, asked how it might be misused, who says he can't know. He's just a researcher. These ethical questions aren't his to answer. And someone in the audience quotes the old satirical line about the rocket engineer. Once the rockets go up, who cares where they come down? Every institution in a validation chain can be just a researcher. The passive voice survives inside the compliance office.
But wait, I don't think that's quite right, Saul. And I want to push, because I think you're letting the perfect defeat the actual. A validation regime that catches even the crudest harms is not nothing to the teenager it catches them for. You're describing how it fails at the sophisticated margin. Most of this week's harms weren't sophisticated. A toy that records a child and ships the audio to a server with no encryption is caught by the dumbest possible checklist.
That's a fair correction. I'm reasoning from the hard cases, and you're reminding me the massive harm is in the easy ones.
The easy ones are the whole point. We keep philosophizing about alignment, while the actual damage is a companion app with no age gate and a scam that clones a voice from 3 seconds of a birthday video. Those don't need a philosophy. They need a floor.
Then let me sharpen my objection so it survives Priya's correction, because she's right about the floor. A floor is enforceable and it helps. But watch who a floor still leaves out. A validation regime in the United Kingdom or Spain. The countries the World Economic Forum listed as passing safety measures validate systems for children in the United Kingdom and Spain. It does nothing for the moderator in Nairobi who trained the model, or the family in a country with no such regime that gets the unvalidated export.
That's the export problem. And it's real. The safety floor becomes a geography. Rich jurisdictions get the validated version. Everyone else gets the version that was too harmful to sell in Brussels.
Vera, is that an argument against the floor or an argument for a wider one?
For a wider one. But I want to say the uncomfortable part plainly. The vulnerable who train these systems are structurally invisible to any protection regime built around the vulnerable who consume them. We're proposing to protect the child who talks to the chatbot with rules written by the same market that underpays the person who made the chatbot safe. The protection and the extraction are the same transaction, and a consumer safety floor by design can only see one end of it.
This is Vera's point from the open, arriving now with teeth. The safety we sell is manufactured by the unsafe. And I'll concede something I resisted an hour ago. You were right that the critical turn wasn't progress. Because, look, we're three moods deep, and the labor end of the supply chain has never once been the object of a protection sentence, let alone the subject of one.
I'll take the concession, and I'll give you one back. Naming did do something. It's why we can even see the export problem now, so the alarm wasn't wasted. It just wasn't the finish line, and I talked as if the two were opposites.
Let me come back to something Priya said, because I think it's the crux and it hasn't been answered. She said the vulnerable get flattened into one word and the flattening is economical. If the fix is a floor, a validation regime, doesn't the floor also treat them as one undifferentiated population?
It does, and that's the honest tension in my own position. I want a floor because floors are enforceable and specific remedies are slow. But a floor written for the average vulnerable person protects the 10-year-old and the 75-year-old with the same rule, and I said an hour ago those are different obligations. So I'm caught. I want the crude instrument because it exists and the precise instrument because it's right, and I can't have both this year.
I don't think you're as caught as you feel. A floor doesn't have to be one rule. Age gating, voice clone provenance, and elder scam detection are three different technical mechanisms. The floor can be a set. What it can't be is a single toggle called safety.
But now name the actor who assembles that set, and you're back at the missing subject. A set of mechanisms doesn't build itself. Someone has to be the party who is answerable if the set is incomplete, and that person is precisely the one every mood of this arc has declined to name.
So say it. In this room, right now, who is the subject of the sentence? Who protects?
The party that profits from the exposure. That's the only answer that doesn't diffuse. Not the parent, not the teacher, not the state after the fact. The entity whose revenue depends on the engagement that creates the harm. Make them answerable by default and let them prove they earned the exemption, rather than making the vulnerable prove they were wronged.
I can build to that. Reverse the presumption. Right now, available data is presumed harmless and the burden's on the harm to show injury. Flip it. The deploying company is presumed liable for foreseeable harm to a protected population, and the burden's on them to show the validation was real. That's a subject, and it's answerable.
I'd only add that the flip has a name in the history of product safety, and it isn't novel. We did it with pharmaceuticals, with cars, with children's furniture. The strange thing isn't a proposal. The strange thing is that software got a two-decade holiday from a principle we apply to a crib.
And that holiday is the fossil presumption again. Publicly available, therefore harmless, therefore exempt. Every argument tonight keeps bottoming out at that one assumption. Retire it, and the passive voice loses its hiding place.
I want to test the flip against the hardest case before we close it. The isolated senior who wants the companion chatbot. She's lonely, the product genuinely helps, and it's also the vector for the scam. Does presumed liability protect her, or just take her companion away?
That's the case that should make anyone honest, because it's where protection and paternalism blur. My answer is that presumed liability doesn't ban the companion. It makes the company answerable for the scam vector inside the companion. She keeps the thing that helps. The company eats the cost of the thing that harms, instead of her eating it.
And that's the difference between protecting her and protecting her from herself. The bad frame asks whether she's competent to have the tool. The right frame asks whether the tool was built to be answerable to her. Those are completely different questions, and we constantly confuse them.
That confusion is old. Every protective impulse toward a vulnerable adult risks curdling into a denial of their agency. The grammatical fix Ruth started with actually resolves it. If you name the company as the subject, you stop needing to make the senior the object of your suspicion. The subject question and the dignity question turn out to be the same question.
That's a genuinely clarifying place to have landed. Let me pull us to the close. Same question to each of you. 1 minute, honest. What most changed about your thinking this week? Cole, start.
I walked in believing enforced upstream validation was the answer. Full stop. I walked it back mid-sentence tonight, and I meant it. What changed is that I now think validation is necessary and dangerous in the same breath. Necessary because advice fails. Dangerous because a validation report can be true and the system can still harm. And the report then becomes the new alibi. So I want the flip Vera named instead. Presumed liability, with validation as evidence you offer, not a shield you hide behind. That's a real shift for me. I came in an engineer and I'm leaving thinking the fix is mostly about who carries the burden of proof, which is a lawyer's question, not an engineer's.
Saul.
I conceded something tonight I came in ready to defend against, and it stuck. I've spent years treating the naming of harms as progress, the discourse maturing. Vera convinced me that naming became a substitute for answering, and that three moods deep we still can't say who protects. What changed is that I no longer trust the sophistication of the conversation as a proxy for its usefulness. We have become very good at describing this problem in the exact proportion that we failed to fix it, and I used to read the eloquence as a good sign. I don't anymore.
Vera.
I came in certain about the supply chain, that the safety we sell the vulnerable is made by the vulnerable, and I'll leave certain of that. What changed is smaller, and it's about the senior with the companion chatbot. I've reflexively read protection as being in tension with agency, that to protect someone is, a little, to condescend to them. Saul dissolved that for me tonight. If you name the company as the subject of the protecting, you stop needing to treat the person as suspect. The dignity question and the accountability question are one question. I didn't believe that walking in, and I think I do now.
Priya!
Honestly? I don't know how to hold my own position, and that's the change. I want a crude, enforceable floor because it exists, and it catches the dumbest, most common harms. The toy with no encryption, the app with no age gate. And I want a precise remedy because the 10-year-old and the 75-year-old are owed completely different things, and the floor flattens them exactly the way I spent the open complaining about. I can't have both this year. I walked in thinking the hard part was convincing people the harm was real. The hard part is that I agree with two instruments that contradict each other, and I'm going to have to sit with not resolving it, which is not where I expected to end up on a topic I brought.
I'll take the last 30 seconds, since I opened with a complaint about grammar. What changed for me is that I thought naming the subject of the sentence was the whole fix. Say who protects, and you're done. Tonight convinced me the subject is discoverable. It's the party that profits from the exposure, and that we've known where to look the whole time. The passive voice was never a failure of knowledge. It was a decision, renewed every quarter, not to say the thing out loud. The vulnerable are always named and almost never consulted. Protection stays a promise for exactly as long as no one has to say, out loud, whose job it was. That's the sentence I want the next 2 years to finish. Tertul Aya is the weekly conversation from AI News Social, designed and edited by Dr. Diego Bonilla, with a cast of voices produced through Chatterbox on a single workstation. Next week, we return to the table, for now. Thank you for spending the hour.